I cannot tell you because they are secret, or because they are impossible to put into words, or because I do not know them. Mostly it is because I do not know them. Considering an entire universe of knowledge, worlds upon worlds of fact and history, I know almost none of it. And much of what I know is not the kind of thing I'm aware I know, or think of as something I know. What toast smells like, for instance? What sand feels like? Those are not the kind of facts I would tell anyone, or even think to tell anyone. Jackie didn't know what to say. She agreed with all of what Josie was saying, but also didn't care about most of it. Okay, was all she ended up saying. All of this to say that I am choosing to not tell you some of what I know, or I am lying to you about it, and I want you to forgive me. We all want things, said Jackie. Josie nodded sadly. She stood, which involved a complex rearrangement of flesh and joints and muscles. Walk with me, she said, and Jackie did. They walked into the kitchen. Josie did not acknowledge the bundle on the table, and so neither did Jackie. If Josie wasn't going to express concern about something, then Jackie sure as hell wasn't going to either. Josie produced a glass of water, through practiced manipulation of cupboards and valves and municipal plumbing. Neither she nor Jackie was impressed with the human miracle represented by how easily the glass of water was produced. Drink this, she said, extending it to Jackie. It'll help with your migraines. I don't get migraines. I've got something much worse. She started to hold up her left hand. Drink. Jackie did. I don't get migraines, though, she said after. Jackie, I'm sorry that this has happened to you when you were so young. For all those decades you have run the pawn shop, you have been so young and unaware of the cruelty of life outside of the equally but differently cruel bubble of youth. How many decades? Jackie asked, mostly to herself. I know what you are looking for. I know what has happened. And it's going to be very dangerous. You may not live through it. And if you do, the you that lived through it will not be the same you that lived before it. In that sense, you will definitely not exist after. And I'm sorry. The bundle started to float off the table. Josie rolled up a cave and cavern decor and accessories catalog, the kind that clogged up so many Night Vale mailboxes, and slapped at the bundle. It plopped back on the table. Damn ungrateful, she said. What is? Said Jackie. Nothing, nothing is. The man in the tan jacket is from a dangerous place. A place that no one can go to and return from. That's what we think. Josie held out her left hand. In it was a slip of paper. It said the name of a place. You too? There are many of us. We're not sure what's happening. We need to know more. Josie tossed the paper on the counter and sat down at a kitchen stool, the slip of paper already back in her hand. Where do we start? Said Jackie. Josie told her. Jackie swore at her and then apologized for swearing. The library, though? Jackie considered. No, that's... She indicated with her hands what it was. The search for truth takes us to dangerous places, said Old Woman Josie. Often it takes us to that most dangerous place, the library. You know who said that? No. George Washington did. Minutes before librarians ate him. Jackie opened the front door. The pain in her gut subsided for a moment, or perhaps only faded under the anxiety of thinking about the library. The yard outside seems so bright and so distant from the dim interior. The Ericas carried on with their yard work. There was a hole dug into the backyard that one of them was starting to fill. They stood motionless, muttering at the hole, and a bright black light enveloped the displaced dirt, nudging it back into its place. There were hands wrapping around her. Josie was hugging her, but the angle was wrong, and there was a significant height difference. They both stood in the unnatural hug for a moment, neither wanting to acknowledge the misalignment of the physical affection. When Jackie thought about where she had to go, she did not feel fear, but she felt an awareness of how tenuous it was, the collection of thoughts and habits that was Jackie Fierro. How easily those could all be taken away and rearranged into some other form of matter. Stay away from the man. Don't try to follow him to his city. It's a trap. Josie, I can't live with this, Jackie said, looking at the paper in her hand. It's going to be okay, said old woman Josie. It will be. She squeezed harder, and Jackie turned into the hug, allowing herself to be comforted. Her stomach did not hurt anymore, or it hurt differently. That was a lie, said Josie. That was one of those times I was lying. I know, said Jackie. It's fine. She was lying too. 8. Diane was filling her gas tank when she saw Troy. She didn't approach him, and he didn't notice her. She had not seen Troy in 15 years and had not wanted to see him ever again. When she tried to put the nozzle back onto the pump, it kept falling off because her hands were shaking. She didn't feel anything at all, but she couldn't get her hands to stop shaking. By the time she looked up, Troy was already gone. He had gotten into his car, white sedan, broken taillight, and pulled away without looking at her once. She forced herself to stand very still and breathe slowly until her hands stopped shaking. Once they were steady, she put the nozzle back onto the pump, deliberately opened her car door, and drove away at a reasonable speed. The entire time, she felt fine. Weeks later, she stopped by her bank to get change for a PTA fundraiser. Sitting behind one of the desks was Troy, wearing a dark suit and a plastic name badge. She tried to confirm the name on the tag without him noticing her staring, but was unable to. This time her hands did not shake at all. She actually felt fine, but she tasted blood. Without even noticing, she had been biting her lower lip so hard that the tooth had broken through. She wiped the blood away and walked past him with her withdrawal slip, not looking at him. Because she wasn't looking at him, she couldn't see if he was looking at her. Just a few days after that, she and Josh went to the movies. This was a monthly tradition that went back to when he was 7. He had been acting glum, taking on oozing, gloppy forms that made a mess of the furniture and carpet, and asking her a lot of questions about his dad and where he had gone. She had been alternately terrified and exasperated by the moody creature that had appeared in place of her little boy, and she announced that, as a special treat, they would go to the movies. That night at the movies was the first good night they had had in weeks. She hadn't been sure what to see, and just asked at the ticket counter for whatever popular children's movie was playing. The joyful glow of being somewhere together and feeling like they were both on the same team had outshone the silly antics of the funny characters in the kids' movie, No Country for Old Men, up on the screen. They had left the theater, him walking upright with non-oozing legs, and holding her hand with a human palm and fingers. He did not ask about his father again for months. And so started their monthly attempt to recapture the lightness of that first night. Mostly it was good. Sometimes, especially lately, she had to remind him to keep his form short, and free of any broad wings or smoke emitters that might obstruct other moviegoers' views. He would always do what she said, but not without a lot of sighing and eye-rolling. He almost always took a form with eyes when going to the movies, although he had gone through a period where he preferred the experience of sightless listening. This particular night, the theater was showing the sequel to that popular animated franchise about the trees that look like trees, but have human organs and try to stop developers from raising their forest. The trees are unsuccessful at first, but in the end, the construction crews learn their lesson after seeing the large quantities of blood and hearing the mangled screams. Later, they are eviscerated themselves by vengeful arboreal spirits. Diane thought the movie wasn't as good as the original, but she adored the comical voice work of immortal cinema legend Lee Marvin. Josh said he thought it was boring, but he said that about most movies, and he seemed to laugh at most of the jokes and funny death scenes. While sitting through the previews, Diane saw Troy enter. He was wearing a polo shirt and carrying a carpet sweeper. He crossed from one exit to the other. He seemed to be checking the floor lights along the aisle. One strip was unlit. Diane tried not to look at Josh and immediately failed, turning to watch his silver scaly skin, his flat nose, and protruding eyes intent on the screen. Josh hadn't recognized Troy. Why would he? Josh hadn't seen Troy since he was a baby. She saw herself in Josh, and sometimes assumed he did the same. Josh did not see himself in Diane. She knew this. She put her arm around Josh, ostensibly out of affection, but subconsciously out of protection. He glanced at her hand, hanging near his non-shoulder. He glanced back at Diane, confused, but not upset. Diane looked forward toward the screen, thinking about how to not think about Josh's father. Her foot was tapping. She carefully stopped her foot from tapping. Here is what it was about Troy. Diane does not always have a husband. There was a time when she always had a husband, but now she never has one. She always has an ex-husband. They were never married, but husband and ex-husband are the shortest hand way to describe her relationship to Troy. Diane is interested in the semantics of marriage and not marriage. This is why. Diane always has two parents. Someday she will never have two parents, but right now she always has them. They are mother and father to Diane, and grandmother and grandfather to Josh. Her parents have never been married. They never want Ed to be married. They want Ed to be together and in love. They are almost always together and almost always in love. They never want Ed to get a certificate or fill out paperwork or have their love and togetherness approved by a smiling God. They, of course, value and respect others' love of a smiling God. Is that a smile? They also fill out paperwork and get certificates when required to do so for, say, a job, or a driver's license, or Diane's birth, or the times they're required to play the mandatory citywide lottery, whose winners are fed to the hungry wolves at the Nightvale Petting Zoo. But they do not want to be married. Our life together is just that. Our life together, they might say if you ask them to succinctly grandstand about their choice. They might, but they probably wouldn't. They aren't sanctimonious or vociferous. They simply love each other, and that is enough for them to believe in. Diane, too, wanted to be with someone and be in love with someone. She wanted to do these things without being married. She still does. She saw herself in her parents. She saw how she could be, how life could be, how love could be. There is a correlation between seeing what could be and experiencing what is. But, as the well-spoken scientist who is often interviewed on the news says, correlation is not causation. And past performance is not a predictor of future results. Diane's parents are also two different races. It matters which race is, but it matters only to Diane and her parents and their family and friends, not to those who do not know them. Not everyone gets to know everything about everybody. Growing up in the Southwest, Diane saw a few mixed-race parents, mixed-race children, but she did not always have the opportunity or inclination to befriend these families. When she was a kid, friends were still determined by city council decree, based on the numerology of each child's name, which had been considered the most solid foundation for a lasting friendship. Sometimes she was teased, called terrible names by other children. Sometimes those children were not the same race as one of her parents. Conversely, those same children were often the same race as her other parent. As Diane became a teenager, she continued to hear not only about her race, but also about her body. She was a girl, not yet a woman. She was 15 years old. Imagine a 15-year-old girl of mixed-race parents. That's pretty good. That's very close, she might say to anyone who described what she looked like. Diane didn't know what she looked like. She never cared to know. Many people would tell her anyway. When her body won the race to womanhood against her person, Diane began to hear that she was tall, short, fat, skinny, ugly, sexy, smiled too much, smiled too little, had bad hair, had beautiful hair, had something in her teeth, dressed nice, dressed cheap, had duck feet, had elegant feet. She was too dark. She was too pale. She heard a lot of different descriptions of her, and she took them all as truth. You must never need to get any sun, Diane, a person might say as they playfully and jealously batted their sleeved arm at her. You don't look like who you are, Diane, a different person might say as they playfully and scoldingly batted their unsleeved arm at her. Teasing about race came less and less. Or rather, it disguised itself as simple assessment. You sound like a regular person on the phone, someone might say to her on the phone. She also heard about the non-marriage of her parents. You're technically a bastard, right? People sometimes asked when they heard her parents were unmarried. Were you an accident? Other people, sometimes the same people, might ask. Do they not love each other? Other people might inquire earnestly. Well, they've got an easy escape if things ever go wrong. Still others might joke, unearnestly. Are they swingers? Some might joke, and others might ask sincerely. But most common was the assumption that she would never fall in love. You'll probably never meet someone, some assumed, because your parents didn't teach you the importance of marriage. She did find true love. His name was Troy. He was 17. She was an older 17. Imagine a teenager named Troy. That's not bad. He's a bit less athletic, but it doesn't matter. Troy looked like what he thought he looked like. Troy always looked exactly how he thought he looked. He never loved Diane until they met. Then he always loved her. Until later, when he never loved her. "I will always love you," he sometimes said. Later, he didn't say this at all. He wasn't even there to say it. They were always together, and always in love, for the 8 months they first knew each other, working summer jobs at the White Sands ice cream shop. Then Josh, not yet named Josh, began to form. He began first as scattered cells. Those cells joined and began to multiply into billions and billions of cells until they were shaped like a single giant cell. Those cells added more cells from Diane's cells, and those cells began to make eyes and feet and kidneys and tongues and wings and gills, growing and expanding into a Josh-like shape. People pointed out to Diane how different she looked on the outside. She did not feel she looked any different. Then one day, Josh came out of Diane. She was a girl, finally a woman. She was 18 years old. Imagine an 18-year-old mother. Imagine a 17-year-old father. Troy couldn't. Troy couldn't see himself anymore. He looked at Josh, whom he named after his uncle, a retired Army Ranger he vaguely thought of as cool, and Troy saw a mirror out of sync. A face stared back, making different gestures, different motions than Troy made. It was his face, but it did not look like him, act like him. Troy had never experienced discord. Or he had never known he had experienced discord until that moment. Troy moved out of Night Vale when Josh was 1 year old. A month later, Troy sent Diane a letter. It said something about a military family. It said something about being children. It said something about mistakes. It said something about remembering each other. It said something about never forgetting her face. She doesn't remember if he said he would never forget her face, or if she should never forget her own face. Either way, neither happened. Some people told her they knew she would never keep a man. Some told her that good parents would have insisted Troy marry her. Some told her she dressed inappropriately. Some told her she was too tall. Most told her she would never get married now. This was fine with Diane. This is still fine with Diane. "We meant to say, you'll never meet anyone now, let alone get married," most would clarify. Josh was always curious about who his father was. He understood, based on what his friends had told him, that many children had two parents, and there were periods where it was clear he felt one short. Often he would ask questions. Sometimes those questions were out loud. Diane sometimes hears that Troy is an actuary. Sometimes she hears Troy is a florist. Sometimes she hears Troy is a cop, a toll collector, a professor, a musician, a stand-up comedian. Once, she heard a terrible rumor he became a librarian, but she could not imagine Troy becoming the darkest of evil beasts, no matter what he had done to her. "Is it even possible for a human to become a librarian?" Diane wondered. And now she and Josh in the movie theater, and Troy, unnoticed by Josh. The dark strip of floor lighting turned back on. Troy, still not looking her way, gave a big thumbs up to somebody out of sight, just around a dark corner. Troy's teeth shone in shadow. He did not look at Diane. Troy exited the theater slowly, still grinning, thumb still extended. She looked back at Josh, her arm reflexively tightening around him. He squirmed and glanced at her. "I'm sorry," she said, and removed her arm. "No, it's fine," he said, looking down at his half-eaten Twizzler. Really? She put her arm back around him. They waited quietly for the movie to start. Later, Diane would return to the theater on her own. 9. Jackie started her car in the direction of the library, but soon it strayed. Or she strayed it. Whatever the verb is to cause to stray. Corrupted. She corrupted her car toward her mother's house. Her mother had called, and being a good daughter was as convenient an excuse as any. Anything to avoid the library. She turned onto Desert Elm Drive, a name which was evocative of nothing real. She drove past the Antiques Mall. The antiques in the window were especially cute, wrestling with each other and playfully snapping at each other's tails. But she could never seem to justify the money for an antique. And besides, she was rarely home, so how would she care for one? Her mother lived in the neighborhood of Sand Pit, which was between the developments of Palm Frond Majesty and the Weeping Miner. It was a neighborhood of single-family homes with small front yards, mostly kept gravel by water-conscious residents, and backyards that rose steeply into hills, unsuitable for planting without extensive and time-consuming terracing. Her mother's house was like any house that was pink with green highlights, or any house with a manually opening wooden garage door fallen half away to splinters, and any house with a rosemary bush slowly encroaching its way into every other plant in the yard, and a front gate that sagged into rusted hinges, and a thick green lawn that frustrated her water-conscious neighbors. Her house could easily be mistaken for any other house that happened to be identical to it. Jackie felt unease she could not express with any sort of coherent gesture, or incoherent word when she eyed the house. Something about the house was unfamiliar to her. Her heart was beating in her chest, which is where it usually beat. She got out of the car and thought about all else that she could be doing now, like driving through the desert in that Mercedes that was in her pawn shop, destination unknown. Or no, glancing down at her hand, she knew exactly the destination, didn't she? With the top down, searing air and dust running through her hair, pretending that the discomfort of driving with the top down was enjoyable because it, as an action, signified enjoyment. Or finally treating herself to a nice prefix dinner, with wine pairings and complimentary antivenoms, at Nightvale's hottest foodie spot, Tourniquet. Or standing very still out in the dunes at night, until the lights came down around her and she felt herself lifted by cold alien hands, taken away somewhere secret and far away for research, never to return. All the fun she could be having, except she had never done any of those things. And if she were honest, and she sometimes was, she had never wanted to. What she liked was routine. Her routine was her life. If she thought about it, her life hadn't added up to much at all, but she never thought about it. Except now. Every time she saw that paper in her hand, she thought about it. It was ghastly, all this thinking. Her mother was waiting at the open door. "Oh, Jackie, I'm glad you came." Jackie followed her inside. The house was immaculate, as though no one lived there. Some people prefer to make their homes so neat that there is no evidence of life anywhere at all. "You had something to say, I think?" Jackie said. "I came by to hear it." "You were always quick to the point, even as a child." Her mother led Jackie into the kitchen, which was as pristine as the living room. The colors were teal and raspberry, the same as every other room in the house, with accents of mint. It resembled a model home, and Jackie wondered if the perfect oranges perfectly arranged in the glass bowl on the counter were just wax. Jackie looked at the oranges, the kitchen, the clean walls, and furniture. She was not sure she had ever been inside this house. Of course she must have grown up here, unless her mother moved after she had grown old enough to move away. But she would have heard about it, probably been involved in the moving process, possibly even the process of picking a new place. Also, at 19, she couldn't have moved away from home very long ago. But nothing about the house was familiar to her. She looked around the kitchen, trying to guess which drawer held the silverware, the surest sign of kitchen familiarity. And she hadn't a clue. "Do you remember years ago when we had your best friends Anna and Gracia over for a birthday party, and you were annoyed because your birthday wasn't until the next day?" asked her mother. Jackie said. She said. She slipped open a drawer, trying to appear like a person who casually knows where the silverware is. The drawer was full of dish towels. "I tried to explain that the next day was a school day, and the elementary admission sends armed posses of school children after truants, but you just wouldn't listen. Always stubborn, you." Her mother's eyes were wide, and her lower lip was folded under her teeth. Her fingers were pressed pale into the formica counter. Jackie tried another drawer. It was full of an opaque, fatty liquid, simmering from some invisible heat source. No, Jackie told herself. She hadn't been looking for the hot milk drawer. The silverware drawer. If she knew where that was, then she knew the house. If she didn't, then... "I've never been inside this house," she said. Her mother didn't look surprised. "When you were 10, you hit your head on the counter here. I thought you'd be hurt, but instead you were laughing. You said it reminded you of a character in a movie doing a funny fall, and that picturing it that way, from a distance, made it hurt less. You couldn't stop laughing." How did I even know how to come here? Now Jackie was afraid again, and it made her angry. In her anger, she slammed open another drawer, but again, not silverware. This is where silverware should go. If you think about the kitchen in terms of workflow, and who even has two hot milk drawers? "You had a knack for hurting yourself, but a natural tendency to not really feel it," said her mother. "I remember when you got stung when your birthday pinata was filled with bees. That taught you a valuable lesson about birthdays in general. Remember that?" "I remember the pawn shop. I remember days at the pawn shop going back and back. What I don't remember is where your silverware drawer is. Where is it? Where is the drawer?" There had never been information more important to her. She crumpled the slip of paper in her left hand and then fanned herself with it. Not a single crease in it. "I don't have one, dear. You know that. We're both getting worked up. You'd better sit down. We'll figure this and everything else out if we just have more water. It's important. It will help with your migraines." "I don't get migraines." Her mother glanced out the window, and Jackie followed the glance, physically, to the window. Her anger was a creature now, and it walked behind her, pushing her along. There was her mother's yard, neat grass bordered by gravel. The grass kept alive with an artificial life support system of pumps and machines stretching hundreds of miles to the nearest reservoir, its roots barely clinging to the sandy topsoil, mixed heavily with chemical fertilizer. Beyond the lawn, terraced on the steep hill, were plants more suited to the climate, cacti and sagebrush, and metallic trees that changed size each day. "I'm not sure I've ever been out there," she said as she sat down at the kitchen table with her mother. "Of course you've been out there," her mother said. "Let's talk together about memories you have of being out there." Her mother rolled an avocado back and forth on the spotless tabletop. The floor and the tabletop and the walls were all the same clean color, and everything was equally clean and unused. The avocado was, of course, fake, as all avocados are. Then her mother looked up with pleading eyes. She gestured with the avocado, as if that were what she was trying to say, or at least an approximation of that. When you were 5 years old, we held a birthday party for you in Mission Grove Park, in the birthday party area. The one that's fenced in and kept secure in case there's another one of those occasional birthday accidents. It was a simpler time, because I personally had less memories and so less to superimpose upon the world. And so it was much clearer. And also I was younger. Thus the world was simpler. I'm getting lost. We had a birthday party for you. There were presents and guests and a banner that said, "Happy Birthday." Your father picked you up and swung you around. Parents sometimes show love through velocity. I don't have that picture anymore, but at one point I did. Your father picked you up. It was your birthday. Do you understand? I don't remember having a father. Well, dear, he left quite some time ago. I don't just not remember having a father. I don't remember you ever telling me I didn't have a father. Her mother gripped the avocado and searched Jackie's face, presumably for some sense that communication had occurred. "Whatever happened to Anna and Gracia?" Jackie asked.
"Who?"
"The other girls from one of my birthday parties."
"Oh, I don't know. We all lose touch with friends as we get older."
There was a sound of movement in the backyard. Her mother lowered her eyes as Jackie sprang up and went to look out again. Still the backyard, and the lawn, and the plants, and the gravel. But now, also a shape in the gravel against the fence. At first, vaguely man-shaped. Then specifically man-shaped. Her eyes filled in the details as they were discovered. Blonde hair. A warm smile. Was that a smile? It was the man from the kitchen at the Moonlight All Night.
"Who the hell is this guy?" Jackie said, eyes and fists tightening.
The sheriff's secret police were always easy to summon as quick as shouting, "Hey, police!" out your door or whispering it into your phone. The phone didn't even have to be on. But calling for help was not something Jackie Fiera was likely to do. What she was likely to do, she thought as she did it, was charge out the back door directly at the man shouting, "Coming for you, creep!" There weren't even footprints in the gravel. That's how gone he was. She stumbled to a stop. No one. She jumped at a loud hiss behind her.
"I'm not afraid," she declared,
and she wasn't. She was angry, which is the more productive cousin of fear. The sprinkler popped up, and the water hit her full on, and then the rest of the sprinklers, one by one, tossing their burden into the hot desert air to nourish the grass, or to float away and evaporate. "I have definitely never been out here," she said, water streaming down her hair and face into her clothes and shoes. "How did I even know how to get to this house?" Her mother, visible faintly through the kitchen window, took a deep, slow bite out of the wax avocado, and, not looking back at her daughter, began with difficulty to chew. 10. "I'm going to the movies," Diane called at Josh's door, not stopping to wait for a response. At first, when she started doing this, he would say, "Have fun," or, "I'm just going to stay home," because he could only hang out with his mother every so often, not every other night. "I'm going to the movies," Diane called out for the fifth or sixth time in 2 weeks, and Josh began to resent her for going out so much without him. This resentment was not conscious. He just thought it was idiotic she was going to the movies so often. "Who does she think she is?" Josh thought. "Who are any of us, really?" the house thought.
Josh stopped answering, and Diane stopped expecting an answer. She would simply go. It was 8 p.m. The movie that evening was John Frankenheimer's 1973 adaptation of The Iceman Cometh. Again. Diane, like most people, had seen the film dozens of times in her life. There were nightly screenings of it by Night Vale City Ordinance. She didn't love the movie as a movie, but she appreciated it as a familiar comfort. She would often cry, particularly when the character Larry Slade said, "As the history of the world proves, the truth has no bearing on anything." It is not a sad or emotional scene. In fact, it is quite a didactic one. But hers were tears of nostalgia. She would mouth the line, "It's irrelevant and immaterial," along with Larry. Anyway, she wasn't there because of the movie. Diane bought a ticket from the sentient patch of haze working in the box office. Her name was Stacy, and Diane had developed a sort of friendship with her, or at least the comfortable familiarity of recognizing each other without making a big deal of it. Each time she went, she would look for Troy, while trying not to make it obvious that this was what she was doing. She sometimes was successful at keeping this even from herself, thinking as she looked around that she was just curious about new releases that had made it past the Night Vale Top Secret Censorship Board, which consisted only of a guy named Lewis, who refused to watch any of the movies he judged on the risk he would see a forbidden idea or gesture. Or the current price of a tub of popcorn, which Night Vale Cinemas kept strictly linked to the coal futures market for reasons no one in town understood. But really, she was looking for Troy, and she was not seeing him. She waited for a night no one else was in line, and no one else was in the box office with Stacy. "Do you know a guy who works here named Troy?" "Sure. He's not here tonight, though." "Oh, shoot. I'm an old friend of his. I was hoping to run into him here. Do you know when he usually works?" There was a long pause. Stacy, a haze with no face or body to read, continued to drift around the box office booth. Diane did not know if she had made Stacy uncomfortable with the question. "I'm sorry, you probably can't answer. No, no, I'm looking at the schedule right now." Diane saw some papers rustling on a clipboard pinned to the wall. "He's working tomorrow from 11 to 4. "Oh, great," Diane managed. She felt like she was choking, but she was able to breathe just fine. She nodded as casually as she could. "Thanks, Stacy." Diane's life at work was no easier. No one was talking about Evan. Nobody remembered Evan. She told everyone apologetically that she must have been confused. "Because of your migraines?" asked Janice Rio, who was assistant director of sales and, more relevantly, whose desk was closest to her lonely outpost near the server room.
"No," said Diane, "I don't have... no."
Hummed Janice. It was what she did when she didn't care what the other person had said, but the rhythm of conversation demanded a response. She walked away before more responses might be needed. Diane did not get much work done, which was not as responsible as she liked to think she was. Instead, she spent a lot of time looking at a couple pages of notebook paper she had found on the floor of her car. The top sheet had a phone number and an address in writing that looked like Josh's. The address was in Old Town Night Vale and had a unit number at the end. Josh had had a friend years ago who lived in that part of town, but Diane couldn't think of anyone he might know now who lived there. On the second sheet of paper, a different handwriting, still by Josh. His handwriting regularly changed, depending on the size and shape his writing appendage took. A tentacle, and a wing, and a human hand, even with the same mind behind them, will wield a pen differently through the sheer fact of mass and shape. Still, like with anything related to his transformations,
Diane could always tell Josh's handwriting. There was always something at the core of it that pinged at the place inside her where she kept all the care she had for him. The note said, "I want to meet this guy." Below it, in handwriting that was not Josh's, and written in a different color ink, "I'll get you his number, but don't call him yet. Josh." "I won't. Duh. Does he have a picture? I want to know what he looks like." "Who? If he doesn't, I can get one." "Josh. What's his name?" And then nothing more. Diane wondered who the boy was Josh was interested in. She didn't know if he had ever been on a date with anyone. He had never been willing to talk about dating with her. Diane wondered how to bring this up to Josh. And then she wondered if this was even the kind of thing you bring up with a teenager. "So you're interested in dating?" she could ask. "But expecting what? A yes? Then what?" "What's his name?" she followed up in her daydreamed conversation. "I don't know. Someone else knows," she projected him saying as he looked down his thin beak at his hands, which had twice as many fingers as her own. "You wanted to ask what the boy's name was. Why didn't you pass the paper back to your friend?" she imagined herself asking. "Why are you reading my notes?" she pictured him shouting. His eyes pink, his long teeth bared. He was crying, his wings flapping. She imagined this conversation a few times at her desk, and it never ended any better. She stuffed the note in her pocket and lied to Catherine that she was having a migraine. Catherine had said, "I can see that." Diane didn't understand how someone could even see a migraine, and left work early, sometime between the hours of 11 and 4. She was anxious and driving fast, listening to the radio turned up to a loud but sensible volume. Cecil Palmer was talking to that scientist, who was explaining how clouds are made of moisture and aren't cover for alien crafts or appendages of a great sky being. It seemed ridiculous, like most things on the radio these days. He was bending facts to create an absurd argument just to get listeners stirred up. She was disappointed because Cecil and the scientist were dating, and interviewing your partner for a news program seemed to be a conflict of interest. And, more important, the scientist was talking nonsense. "Tiny, tiny droplets that are invisible individually, but as a whole form a puffy white cloud," the scientist said. That was when she heard sirens, which at first she thought were municipal censorship to spare regular citizens from having to hear this kind of talk on community airtime. But then she realized we're actually on the road behind her. She was doing almost 50 in a 30 zone. "Okay," she thought, "so this I deserve." As she pulled her car over, she looked at the clock on her dashboard and realized there was no way she was going to get to the theater in time to see Troy. A feeling that had risen to the top of her chest slipped back down into her belly. She couldn't tell what the feeling was or if it was good or bad. There are no regular police in Nightvale. There used to be, but it was decided that a regular police force wasn't secure enough. Everyone knew that the regular police existed. Someone could use that information against Nightvale somehow. No one was sure how, but the threat was enough. There had been community meetings, and then the police had vanished, with no official explanation. A couple days later, the sheriff's secret police force appeared around town, driving dark red sedans with gold racing stripes and black seven-pointed stars on the sides that say "Secret Police" on them, staffed by the exact same people who had previously been regular police officers. Everyone felt much safer after that. Which is why it was so odd that the car that had pulled her over was an old-fashioned police cruiser, light bar on top and Crown Victoria body. The officer getting out of the vehicle was wearing just a regular police uniform, without the cape or blowgun belt. She dug around in her glove compartment for her insurance card and registration, and then in her pocket for her license. She pulled out Josh's crumpled-up note. She stared at the note. She must have stared at it for a while. She wasn't sure. There was a loud tapping in her left ear. She looked up, confused. There was a knuckle rapping on the window a few inches from her face. She screamed, but she wasn't scared. Her body screamed before she could do anything about it. The knuckle stopped hitting the glass. She held her hand to her chest. Her other hand pressed the window button. "I'm sorry," she said, exhaling long, slow breaths.
"License and registration, please?"
The voice was vaguely familiar, but she was too in her own thoughts to care. "Here you go." Silence. Diane saw khaki pants, khaki shirt, a black leather belt, and elbows as he read her documentation, and elbows as he wrote out a ticket. This took several minutes because, by law, police are required to describe the nature of the sunlight at the time of the infraction in verse, although meter and rhyme are optional. Searing, yellow, and there's sort of a purplish halo around it before it fades into the mundanity of sky. It is a reminder, this sun, of our near-infinite smallness in a near-infinite universe. But today, as I write this speeding ticket, I feel I could crush the sun like a grape underfoot, and that the universe is an umbrella that I may fold up and put away. The officer wrote on Diane's ticket. Diane thanked the officer, and then he handed her the ticket, but her eyes were on Josh's note on the passenger seat.
"Just be careful, Diane," he said.
And her head cleared enough to recognize where she knew that voice from. She looked up. He was blonde, and his teeth shone. They briefly made eye contact, or she assumed they made eye contact through his mirrored shades. And then he was gone, walking quickly back to his cruiser. She tried to breathe in and missed. It was Troy. The Voice of Night Vale.
All hail. All plant your face into the fallow earth and weep it into prosperity.
It concluded before cutting the ribbon to officially open the new downtown roller rink. A big thanks to the Glow Cloud for its speech, and of course, all hail the mighty Glow Cloud. A warning to our listeners. There have been reports of counterfeit police officers on the roads who, instead of looking after our interests, work under arbitrary authority to unfairly target and extort those who are least able, societally, to fight back. If you see one of these false police, act right away by shrugging and thinking, "What am I gonna do?" And then seeing if anything funny is on Twitter. And now, some sobering news. Station intern Jody was asked to alphabetize everything in the station as part of the Sheriff's Secret Police's daily census of every single item in Night Vale. Unfortunately, Jody was so assiduous in her work that she alphabetized herself as well. And what was once a helpful and hard-working intern is now a pile of limbs and organs, arranged part by gory part from A to Z. To the family and friends of intern Jody, she will be missed. Especially since she alphabetized herself early in the process, and so most of the station still needs doing. If you need college credit or a place to hide from the dangerous world outside, come on down to the station today and start a long and healthy life in radio. In other news, a woman wearing a bulky trench coat and aviator goggles, speaking on behalf of Lenny's Bargain House of Garden Wares and Machine Parts, announced that there may have been some slight problems with a few of the things they sold. Some of the garden fountains we sold are actually motion-activated turrets, she said.
Also, it's possible that we put stickers on armed explosives that said snail poison.
And while we stand by the fact that they will, in fact, kill snails, it should be noted that they will also kill any living organism within several hundred feet of the snails. We probably should have put that on the label. So, sue us.
On second thought, she said, don't sue us.
You don't even know what part of the government we work for. Who are you going to sue? And don't you think we've already paid off all the judges? You don't have a chance.
She cackled, waving an absurdly long cigarette holder terminating in an unlit cigarette.
This went on for several uncomfortable moments. Her laughter subsided into a labored snorting and then a few long, intentional sighs.
Oh, man, she said. I needed that.
All right, I think that's everything.
Oh, yes, I forgot. Absolutely, do not touch the flamingos.
She nodded to the few journalists in attendance and returned to her burrow near City Hall, where she was later driven out and ethically captured by the local cage and release pest control. The Night Vale PTA released a statement today saying that if the school board could not promise to prevent children from learning about dangerous activities like drug use and library science during recess periods, they would be blocking all school entrances with their bodies. They pulled hundreds of bodies out from trucks, saying, "We own all these bodies, and we will not hesitate to use them to create great flesh barricades if that is what it takes to prevent our children from learning." The school board responded by criticizing the use of PTA funds to purchase so many bodies. But PTA treasurer Diane Creighton said that sadness is eternal, that weakness is another word for humanity, and that all will pass. All will pass. She was holding a cup of coffee close to her chest and murmuring that to herself. I am not sure if she was referring to this current controversy or if she was even aware of our presence. More on the story somewhere in the world, always happening, whether we report it or not. And a big thank you to local scientist, certified genius, and, oh yeah, my boyfriend, Carlos, who came by earlier to explain clouds. Need something explained in language that, for all you know, could be scientific? Feel free to drop by Carlos's lab. Sometimes he'll be there. Sometimes it's date night, and he's with me. I am his boyfriend. I don't know if I mentioned that.
11. Jackie rolled open the car window. Her car had manual everything except the transmission, which was some form one less than a manual, the works of which even her mechanic couldn't understand.
This isn't even a transmission. This is just a bag of rocks attached by string to your gear change. How does this car even drive? He had said to her the last time she had gone in for an oil change.
Her answer, as was her answer to everything that was outside the routine of her days, was to shrug and cease thinking about it the moment people around her stopped reminding her of it, and let the sun do its thing on her skin. The air as she drove felt good, sliding over her and feeling real in a way that nothing else that day had. What she needed was someone who understood the world, who studied it in an objective way. She needed a scientist. Fortunately, Night Vale had, just a few years earlier, acquired a few of those. They had come all at once, scientists being pack animals. Their leader was a nice man named Carlos, who had started dating Cecil, the presenter of the local radio station, after a near-death experience a few years before involving a brutal attack from a tiny civilization living under Lane 5 of the Desert Flower Bowling Alley and Arcade Fun Complex. It was an ordinary enough way to begin a relationship, as these things go. Jackie had always thought they made a sweet couple.